Good morning. I invite you to open your Bibles up to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7. We'll get started from there in just a minute. I want to echo what Brother Pink said as he got up to kick us off this morning. We're here to do God's will, and we're here to do it God's way. And so, if you're new here and you haven't worshiped with us before, things may seem very plain and simple, and I assure you that's by design. And the sermon that we're going to go through today is not going to have anything fluffy or new. I mean, we're going to study from the Bible, and that's why I want you to turn there. But I'm telling you, I wouldn't have it any other way. I want you to leave here knowing more about God in His Word than when you came. And that's my goal this morning. And if you don't know more about the Bible, which I believe is God's inspired Word, then I haven't done my job. And for that, I would find myself thinking that was inexcusable. And that's not something you're going to get all the time. I remember going up to Anna's house in Knoxville, and there's a big church near where she lives, and they had some summer series called Summer at the Movies. Well, that sounds exciting, doesn't it? And yet it was a religious thing. And I pulled it up on their website, and they talked about this Summer at the Movies series at church. It's a series that allows us to experience God's love for us through the films we know and love. Our lineup is full of movies that have divine fingerprints all over them, which inspire us to notice and experience Jesus in a new way. Well, I mean, if that seems weird to you, that's weird to me. That they look at popular movies and try to make some spiritual correlations to it, when what we need is exactly what God has given us and tells us. And I pray that that doesn't seem outdated to you, because that's exactly what have brought people to saving faith in Jesus, is the Word of God. And that's what I want to convey to you today. I mean, just think about it another way. It was announced Wednesday night. I had a procedure. I'll just tell you all, because I'm tired of telling you individually. I had a colonoscopy. I'm getting old. And let me tell you, before you plan any sort of procedure, you want to know who's going to do it and their credentials for doing such. And, you know, I got a really good doctor at Emory who is well thought of by others in the profession. Could you imagine looking at a doctor's credentials and him telling you, oh yeah, well, I went to surgery at the movies, and I saw some great films about surgery. And we're going to have a good time today. No. You would want someone that knew the details, that knew exactly what they were supposed to know and what to do. And it may seem tedious and not as fun, but that's what we look for from surgeons. Let me tell you, that's what you should look for and demand from your church. And I want to go through Luke chapter 7 to you this morning and hope that it's encouraging and inspiring to you as well. Again, just by way of introduction, welcome. And I want you to think about an answer to this question. I normally put a picture up first and then the title, but I'm doing it reverse because I want you to guess who I'm going to put up here. If I told you I was looking for a picture of someone that Jesus said had the greatest faith in Israel, all of Israel, who would that be? I mean, the greatest faith. Maybe one of the apostles, right? I mean, those were hand-picked men. Maybe it was somebody else. Well, not quite an apostle, but another great person. Who would be the picture that I would put up here? The greatest faith in Israel. Well, in Luke chapter 7, we're going to find out it's probably the last person you would expect. We're going to learn about the great faith of a centurion, a soldier in the Roman army. And in doing so this morning, I want to set the stage for you. And the first part of the lesson will be just learning a little bit about the context of where this story takes place, the location that it takes place in, and a little bit more about the setting. And then once we come to understand where this fits into the ministry of Jesus, we can hone in on something that only happened two times in the Bible that we read about. Jesus using the phrase that he marveled at something. Jesus was surprised. Jesus was amazed at someone. And so it surely is worth our time to see the type person that would cause Jesus, God in the flesh, to marvel and be amazed. Well, as we start our study this morning in Luke chapter 7, I want to talk to you about where this story is going to take place. We find it in the city of Capernaum, which is right on the Sea of Galilee. And I got a map up here, just as an aside. I go to great lengths to try to find Bible maps, and they're all very small and very horrible. So I had to make this map using Google Maps. So there's a bunch of names on there for current day towns, but that's where the ancient city of Capernaum was, and it's not a bustling city today, but it's a historic place that was on the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. Just to give you some relational thing, Nazareth was where Jesus was from, even though we know he was born in Bethlehem, but this is in the northern part of the nation of Israel. And this is where the majority of the ministry in Jesus' public life took place. Now, we see stories of him in Jerusalem, and if you're not a student of the Bible, you might think, well, Jesus lived in Jerusalem. Well, he didn't. He would go up to Jerusalem, which was down on the map. He would go there for the many feasts that the Jews had during the year. Jesus would go for Passover and other things, and yet he would often retire back to where his home base was, the town of Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee. And it's around this area that many things that happen in the Gospels happened. And I'm sure you're familiar with most of these. Jesus calling his apostles, not all of them, but Peter and John, I mean, those that were fishermen, this happened around the Sea of Galilee, where they left their nets and followed him. It was on this body of water that it was real stormy and the disciples were afraid, and Jesus rebuked the sea and calmed him, and they said, wow, this is unusual. This is where he walked on the water and came to them. This is where he conducted the Sermon on the Mount on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, where he cast out demons and swine ran into the sea. It was on the southern eastern end, I think, of that. Feeding the 4,000, feeding the 5,000. All these things happen in this general area. And while, again, we're not as familiar with the geography, this is what's going to happen in verse 1, where it says, when he had completed his discourse in the hearing of the people, he went to Capernaum. Now, we have to understand a little bit more about the discourse that he had just been talking about. When he had completed all his discourse in the hearing of the people, well, to know what he's talking about, you've got to take a page and flip back to the prior chapter in your Bible. So in chapter 6, what takes place in the book of Luke? Well, normally we go to Matthew 5, 6, and 7 to find this. But in Luke chapter 6, we have Luke's recording of the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount, I mean, if you know nothing about the Bible, you've probably heard of that. And the Sermon on the Mount is really the pinnacle of what we would consider Christianity, or the characteristics of a Christian. And in that Sermon on the Mount, I mean, we won't take the time to elaborate on all of its themes, but Jesus talks about that if you're going to be a follower of God, you've got to look like this. You got to be this type of person. You got to live this way. And so, by and large, it is a treatise on what Christians are to be. And specifically, he goes into what righteousness looks like. Remember how he would contrast the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, and how they would have an outward righteousness with the things that they did, the prayers they offered, the gifts that they gave. And yet for Jesus, well, he highlighted what true inner righteousness looked like. He talked about what love in a Christian life would look like. Not just that you do good to your mom and your dad or your family, but that you love even your enemies, people that abuse you and persecute you. And if you love those and do good to them, then you're like your Father who is in heaven. He talked about the importance of not judging other people and looking to yourself in humility at your own weaknesses and failings, instead of standing in judgment for everybody else, everyone else's problems. And he talked about the good type works that we ought to be doing, and the generosity that we're to have, the kindness that we're to exhibit to everyone. And ultimately, he talks about building faith in Jesus. How a Christian isn't someone that just is going to hear these sayings of his and go off and do something different. But the right kind of person is going to hear what Jesus said and believe it, and his house is going to be built on a rock. And so it wasn't just good themes, but really it was an acceptance of who Jesus was that he closed the sermon with in Matthew chapter 7 and Luke chapter 6. Now, why is that relevant? Well, it's very relevant because we're going to find in chapter 7, after Jesus talks all about what the perfect godly man or woman is going to look like, he's going to go into a town right nearby after preaching, and he's going to find the embodiment of this individual. Wouldn't that be great? It's not just a theory, but it can be lived out and demonstrated in the life of a person. And he's going to see a person that he's going to say, "Man, I haven't seen this type of great faith. No, not in all of Israel." And so let's go ahead and read the text together if you got Luke chapter 7 open. And it says that when he completed all his discourse in the hearing of the people, he went to Capernaum, and a centurion slave who was highly regarded by him was sick and about to die. And when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of his slave. When they came to Jesus, they earnestly implored him, saying, "He's worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built us our synagogue." Now Jesus started on his way with them. And when they were not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes. And another, 'Come,' and he comes. And to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him and turned and said to the crowd that was following him, "I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. This was it. This was the man that outshone all other people in Israel as far as his faith went. And he was a centurion. We don't even have details about his name. But we know one thing about him being a centurion is that this is probably the least likely person that could have ever been elevated in the minds of a Jewish rabbi. Just in general. Because when you think about who this is, a centurion is a member of the Roman army. All right, he's a member of the Roman army. Now, what is the Roman army to a Jewish person at this time? Well, we're not on good terms with them. Because you see, they're occupying our nationalistic space. And any chance we get, we want to evict these people. Because by divine right, the nation of Israel belongs to us, the Jews. And so there were always these undercurrents of political problems, and fightings, and treaties, and some attempts at peace. Because really, they were under the thumb of the Roman Empire. And yet Rome said, "Well, we're going to allow you to kind of manipulate your nation a little bit. You can still have your Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, but you can't really make decisions that we would disagree with. I mean, you can have your high priest, but you still got to come before our governors, people that are in charge. And oh, by the way, we're going to have our army stationed in key cities just to make sure that things are going to go okay." In general, a centurion is not a friend to a Jewish person. I mean, he's a soldier. He's a combatant. And as you could imagine, a soldier in a day and age when you didn't have missiles and helicopters and pilots, you were enforcing things in a very physical, direct way. And they're not just going to make friends anyway with people, just by and large. And yet this person is very key to the story. He was someone that in general in this time, if they're not actively fighting a battle, is tasked with keeping the peace. They're just keeping things in order. If there are problems, then these guys are going to be called because there's people fighting and arguing. They're throwing dust up in the air. And this guy's going to come and he's going to make sure that whatever the problem is going to be taken care of. You see this kind of happen with Paul later on as Paul would cause problems and the Jews would cause problems. Paul's not causing problems. The Jews are causing problems with Paul. And all of a sudden the military shows up trying to sort it out and separate people. And they would throw him in prison to protect him and to guard him. And then they would find out he's a Roman citizen and they would have to do something different. And so that's what's going on here in Israel. And they're often involved in administrative duties. So enforcing the taxation from Rome, making sure that Rome gets what they're supposed to. A man in authority and sending people out to make sure things are done as they ought to be done. I mean, this guy's a leader. He's a government official. But he's somebody that, from all accounts, is first and foremost an experienced soldier. I got this quote up here from a dictionary online about centurions. Centurions were expected to lead by example and display the greatest courage on the battlefield. How did someone get to be a centurion? Well, you're not voted into office and run some political campaign. You were awarded that rank through your demonstrated valor on the battlefield. And they expected that to continue. When you go to battle, the centurion wasn't in the back telling everybody, hey, you go forward. They're out there in the hottest part of the battle and they're fighting and leading these people. And so when you think about who a centurion is, I mean, they're a winner on the battlefield in the greatest army of that time. And I'm telling you, for all these things we know about centurions, they would be the last people you would expect to have the greatest faith. A pagan army soldier? Surely no. I'm going to tell you, of all the centurions in the Bible, that they really are presented in a good light. You think about the centurion at the foot of the cross of Jesus, the soldier who said, surely this man was righteous. You think about the first Gentile convert. We know his name, Cornelius, who was a devout man. You see, what it took to be a man of character in the Roman army, guess what? That same type character is going to be on full display in the story of what Jesus is looking for. So I want to share with you, as we turn our attention to the second half of the lesson, what are the four things that we read about that make this guy a paragon of faith? And why is that relevant to us? Why am I even preaching this lesson? I don't want you to go out and be a centurion. I don't want you to go join the military and lead people in battle. I want you to be someone that God will be proud of. I want you to be someone that God would seek to honor and be amazed at your faith. And to do that, I can show you what that took when Jesus was on the earth. It's the same thing today. So if we can mirror these four attributes of this guy, then you're going to go a long way to pleasing God. So let's jump right in then. And I'll have the verses up on the screen so you can follow along. The first thing that sticks out to me as we think about this centurion is this. This centurion showed great love. The centurion showed great love. And each of the companion verses I'll have are verses that are taken straight from the Sermon on the Mount in Luke chapter 6. In Luke 6, in verse 27, it says, I say to you, love your enemies and do good to those that hate you. Verse 32, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. Now this story, the centurion, is about his love. Now, why would this be so unique? Well, here's what makes this story unique. There are a lot of people that went to Jesus. A lot of people that have come to God and said, God, I need your help. Whether it's the 10 lepers or whether it's like Naaman back in the old days, who was also a military leader. And these people came to God in hopes of some great miracle to be done for who? For them. Naaman's story is not about Naaman coming for someone else. It's about Naaman. It's about me. And the lepers are all about healing me. But this centurion is not about, look, I'm a great man and I've got a big problem and I need your help. No, it's about his slave, his servant, who was sick. a guy that was in his house under his authority, not a family member, not a friend, but someone who really, by all accounts, is viewed as a possession. And yet, what is said about him? A centurion had a servant who was sick. But notice the last part of verse 2. He was highly valued by him. He thought well of him. He cared about him. And when you think about what made this story special, it starts right out of the gate. Here's a man that loves, but he loves someone, by all accounts, he shouldn't care about at all. What if your servant dies? Well, you get another servant. What if your slave dies? You get another slave. Like, I'm important, and I got stuff to do, and I'm not concerned about these things. Yet, this man's heart was touched by the plight that the servant was in. Now, you'll find the same passage detailed a little bit differently in Matthew chapter 8. So, right after the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7, you'll see Matthew 8 open up with the same story. And it goes into a little bit more detail about the sickness that this man was under. It said he had some kind of paralysis, and that there was great pain associated with it. So I don't know if he had a stroke. I don't know what had happened to cause paralysis and pain. But in his mind, he's close to death. And it grieved him. And so you know what he was going to do? He was going to, at his own request, go and start asking for something to be done for this man. So we see here in Luke chapter 7 that he goes and asks some Jewish friends of his to go talk to this person that he's heard about named Jesus. And he goes and asks these Jewish people, I'm sure, because he thinks, well, I mean, maybe that they're going to have some good conversation with him, and that Jesus would appreciate them more than he might appreciate me. I mean, I'm nobody that Jesus would view as a friend. And so let me get some Jewish leaders, and you go ask Jesus on my behalf, that for this poor servant, could you do something for him? It made me think of the Good Samaritan. How you run across a person that you really have no business loving, and yet the Good Samaritan goes to such great lengths to ensure this man is taken care of. This Samaritan, you know, puts him on his own animal and lets him ride while he walks. This man takes him to the inn and gives this guy money and says, here's a blank check. You do whatever is needed, and if there's more spent, I'll repay it when I come. That's Jesus' example of love, and here is this happening in the flesh. This man says, I got somebody that I really care about. He's a servant of mine, but I want you to do him some good. Number one, the centurion showed love. Just think about this in your own life as it reflects to your relationship to God. I mean, are we going to God for people in our lives that we really might not like? Might not deserve our care and concern, but we're so compassionate for those people that we go to God for them on our behalf? Or is your prayer life centered on you? Is it all about you? God, I need this, and God, I need that. Well, then you're not like the centurion. The centurion's coming on behalf of those less fortunate. Secondly, not only did he show love, but the centurion was a man of great generosity. All right, he was a man of great generosity. Now, this blows me away. I mean, you remember in verse 4 and 5 that we read? That when these guys come to Jesus on behalf of the servant, notice what they said. Oh, Lord, he's worthy. This man is worthy to have you do this for them. Why? Verse 5. He loves our nation, and he's the one who built us our synagogue. Built us our synagogue. Could you imagine? Now just think about it in our situation here today. They've been talking about here building a building for the last 7 or 8 years, I think. And imagine if some guy came up down the road who had no affiliation with the church and is like, I'm going to pay $2 million to build your building. I mean, what would you think about that? I mean, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? I mean, all the members here, I mean, shouldn't we, if we care enough, be able to pull in and make it happen? But here, this outsider cares enough about the Jewish synagogue that he's the one that paid for it to be built. I mean, that level of generosity tells you a lot about a person. And Jesus had just been talking about that very thing back on the Sermon on the Mount, verse 35 of Luke 6. Love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He Himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Down at verse 38, give, and it will be given to you. They will pour into your lap a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. Here's a man that's going to test that theory. He was generous. And was generosity going to be showed and returned to him? All right, so again, think about this as I put these points on the board. I mean, true generosity is such a rare trait. I mean, a lot of us will do good, as I've talked about in sermons past, but we'll do good to those that do good to us. And we'll do good to our mama. And we'll do good to our dad. And we'll do good to our wife on Valentine's Day. But who is truly generous for someone that can never repay them and that you receive no benefit? What benefit did this man have for building a Jewish synagogue? He was not a Jew. He was never going to be able to go in the temple like they would. He was never going to be able to experience the promises given to the offspring of Abraham like they would, and yet he did it anyway. All right, this is a good man, to the point where Jewish people said, I got to admit it, he's worthy. This man is worthy for these things to have been done to you. Have you done anything in your life to where people would say, this guy's generosity is off the charts? It makes him worthy, Lord, of whatever he's asking. That's number two. He displayed great generosity. Number three, and these aren't in order of importance, but man, they all add up to something great. Number three, he showed humility. He showed humility. Look, if I was a centurion and I had done great things for Israel and I was a good man, don't you think that would make you feel like, I'm going to stop by and see Jesus? You know, I'm going to tell Jesus, I'm the guy. You know, I built the synagogue here. You spend a lot of time in Capernaum? Yeah, I'm that guy. And Jesus, I mean, shouldn't you let me in? Let me tell you, that's not the spirit that this guy had. What was the spirit that this man had? Okay, so he sends these Jewish people to go ask Jesus, Jesus, can you come heal my servant? And Jesus agrees. And as Jesus is on his way, something in this man's conscience bothered him. He thought to himself, well, I really don't want Jesus to come here. Now, why doesn't he want Jesus to come here? He had just asked Jesus to show up. He's bothered by it because notice what he said in verse 6. I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. You want to talk about humility? He didn't even want to trouble Jesus with coming his way and staying under his roof because he's just not worthy. You remember the disciples saying something similar when they would experience the greatness of Jesus. Peter saying, Lord, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man. Lord, I'm not worthy to be in the same boat with you. And that's what this centurion thought. Now contrast that with the Jewish people who would come and recline and stay around Jesus. Jesus would come in their house. And how would they treat Jesus under their roof? Just like he was a curious person. And when people would come in, like the sinner woman that bathed his feet with her hair and perfume, and they said, well, what kind of man would allow a sinner to do this? And Jesus chastised them. Here I've come under your roof, and you've done nothing for me. You've given me no kisses. You've given me nothing. You've not washed my feet. And this woman's done all those things. You love little, Jesus would go on to say. They didn't view Jesus as somebody to be humble toward, but this man did. This man who had every right, above any of us, to demonstrate his position and his power and his rank. But he didn't do it. He said in verse 7, I did not presume to come to you. I did not presume to come to you, Lord, because I know I'm not worthy to have this kind of relationship with you. Leave it to a soldier to appreciate authority. Leave it to a soldier to recognize when someone's in a great position that I'm not just going to walk up and talk to them like they're a buddy or a friend of mine. I'm reminded of the man in the Gospels who wouldn't even lift his eyes up to heaven but beat his breast saying, "Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner." He wouldn't even lift his eyes up toward heaven. And yet the proud man who went to pray, he'll just stand staring up into heaven. "Hey God, it's me." What's your relationship toward God like? Are you someone that's demonstrating the humility Jesus requires? In Luke chapter 6, and you think about the Sermon on the Mount, He speaks to the one who would say to his brother, "Hey, let me take the speck out that is in your eye, when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye. You hypocrite! First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck that is in your brother's eye." That was this man's attitude. All he saw was his own unworthiness. That's what he saw. He wasn't judging anybody else but himself. He demonstrated that meekness, that humility that God talked about in the Beatitudes. The poor in spirit, he recognized his own poverty and destitute nature in the face of a holy God. And so the centurion, I mean, he's demonstrating this amazing humility. And fourth and finally, ultimately what consummates faith is this. The centurion showed trust in who Jesus was. How did he demonstrate this trust? Well, as we read in verse 8 and 9, he said, "Jesus, I'm coming to you because I too am a man who's under authority. And I've got soldiers under me, and when I tell them to do something, they just do it. And I recognize you as someone that has that same power and authority. And if you say something, Jesus, I bet it will be done. You don't have to come here. You just say the word, and my servant will be healed." Let me tell you, this man had trust and faith in God. "Everyone who comes to me," Jesus said in Luke chapter 6 and verse 47. And I'll tell you, that's the first thing that shows the centurion's trust, is he went to Jesus. You know, if you got all the money and the power and the prestige, and you got a servant that you care about or someone you care about that's sick, you can just go get it done, right? But somehow along the way, he had come to a belief in that Jesus, he's not just a normal person. He believed in who Jesus was to the point where he said, "I recognize this is the place I need to put my efforts. I got a problem, I'm putting it at your feet, Jesus." All right, he believed in Jesus. Not just believed in Him, but he believed in Jesus' willingness to help. He knew the kind of man that he was, and he trusted that if I could just get this case in front of Jesus, he would do something about it. And not just his willingness, but third, he believed in Jesus' ability. He demonstrated that because he didn't say, "Well, maybe Jesus will come here and it might take a while, it might take a few hours of Jesus doing something and then something will happen." He said, "No. Jesus, if you say the word, I bet this thing could happen." He believed and trusted in Jesus' ability. And that's why Jesus said, after this occurred, Jesus just stopped and said, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." Now you contrast that with the Jews, who Jesus would do miracle after miracle, and they would say, "Hey, can you show us another sign? How many signs do you need? How many people would doubt Jesus? Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" How many of Jesus' own family would say, "I mean, isn't this Joseph's son, the carpenter?" And yet this centurion, he recognized Jesus for who he was almost immediately. And even though he was outside of God's family, he came to the only place he knew that could help him. He came to Jesus. And he demonstrated his faith. The last question I got up here, and then I'll close with another verse. How often do we go to Jesus in full assurance of faith? How often do we take our problems to somewhere else when Jesus is waiting for us to come to Him and trust that He is and that He's able and willing to help us? I want to come to Jesus with that sort of thing. Look, I say all this because it matters. Your relationship to God matters, and it's demonstrated through faith. And I want to close with what Jesus said after this miracle in Matthew chapter 8, verses 11 and 12. And notice what Jesus said to everybody after saying this man had such great faith. Jesus said, "I tell you, many will come from the east and the west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." The Jewish people were perfectly equipped to demonstrate the kind of faith this centurion had. They were uniquely positioned. Having grown up with the law and the promises and the miracles of God in the Old Testament and the family history of time and again, God being there for them to save them. And yet their faith wasn't what it needed to be. Yet here was an outsider who experienced Jesus and ended up with the type of faith that he said should be emulated by the rest of the family of God, and that those type people, this centurion and others like him, are going to come from the outside and they're going to sit down to eat with Abraham in heaven. But Abraham's children, they're going to be on the outside. Now, how does that relate to you? I'll leave you with this as we close. Look, there are many of you here that have heard the stories of the gospel. You were positioned just like the Jews to know exactly what God wants, to know exactly the kind of person He is, because you've heard the lessons and you've seen the faith of your family, and yet you continue to push back against Jesus Christ. And yet somebody will walk in the door who grew up a heathen, who grew up not doing what they were supposed to do, and they'll walk right down and respond to the gospel. Brethren, there's no excuse for people that ought to know better. If you're a son or a daughter of the kingdom, and you're a member of the church, or you've been coming to church, you've been sitting here, but you haven't turned your life over to God, I want you to do that. And if you're not, and you're on the outside, and you're like, "Hey, I want to have that kind of faith, you just tell me what to do." Well, Jesus will do that. If you're willing to confess Him before men and change your life and order it after the pattern of Jesus, He'll save you. And if you're willing to confess that belief and then die as Jesus died to those sins through repentance and baptism and be raised to walk a new person, God will forgive everything you've ever done. And you'll be added to His family. And you won't be some outsider in an opposing army. You'll be a son and daughter of God. You'll be a part of this family. We want you to do that now. Think about it. If you need to come forward as we stand and sing a song to encourage you.